Okay, I'm here with Shane today, and for today's show, we're going to talk about social engineering. You know, what is social engineering? You know, how do we incorporate that into a pen test? You know, how do we incorporate that into a security posture? And then for the second half of the show, we're going to talk about red teaming and vulnerability assessment. So let me start off with, you know, describe, you know, what is social engineering? You know, and not in the general sense, but within the context of a, you know, a penetration test and within the context of information security. You know, what is social engineering within that framework?
Sure. Well, social engineering is basically exploiting the human weakness. You know, it's going after the people within the organization. Now, my definition of social engineering is different from a lot of other people's social engineering. For me, social engineering is an interpersonal interaction. It's where a human-to-human interaction takes place, right? So it's me talking to you over the phone, face-to-face. Me sending you a phishing email is not social engineering, right? So under that definition, the social engineering toolkit should be called the phishing toolkit, because that's what it does. It sends out phishing emails. So basically, it's person talking to person. And within a, you know, the context of a penetration test, it's obviously you trying to gain access to a resource that you otherwise shouldn't have access to via the fine art of schmoozing and or bullshitting, right? So it's either me talking my way into a physically restricted or sensitive area within, you know, on site, or me extracting information from someone over the phone, or me talking someone into giving me credentials they shouldn't, or, you know, so on and so on. But it's person-to-person contact with the end result of them giving you or allowing you something that you really shouldn't have.
Interesting. So, I mean, describe the social aspect of, you know, the security system as a sort of attack surface. You know, what are some of the exploits you use? And, you know, more importantly, you know, are these exploits sort of systematic? That is, you know, for you could use them across pen tests, you can use them across assessments.
Well, yes and no. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of social engineering, is that no two targets are alike, right? I mean, if you're hitting an Apache server running this version, you know, and you have a vulnerability for that version, it's going to work, right? Place to place to place. Social engineering, I can call three different people with the same pretext. Might fly with two, the third it doesn't. Flip it around, use a different pretext, might work with, you know, the first one and not with the last two. Or it might work with all three, or it might work with none. That's kind of the fun of social engineering. From an attack surface, though, there's lots of ways to go. You know, it really depends on a couple things. I mean, when I do a social engineering attack, well, it really depends on what the client's outcome is. If it's just for a pen test, then, you know, basically what I'd like to do is usually pose as an insider, right? So I will find areas of what I call the circle of confusion, kind of like in photography, the areas that don't come into focus are the circle of confusion. So what I like to exploit within an organization are things like, you know, mergers, or interdepartmental differences, or political things, or, you know, chaos or change within the company. Because if you can kind of exploit those areas where there's kind of a reasonable doubt, or where there's a lot of churn or chaos, you can really kind of help. I'm trying to think of the words here. It can really help your pretext, because if there's kind of a lot of confusion. So, for instance, if there's two companies that have merged, right? It's very easy for me to pose as a member of the merging or merged company, calling the other and saying, yeah, I'm just trying to confirm these following, you know, these things, and here's how we do it over here, but I'm not sure if you guys are doing it the same over there. And you can even do that when you're talking, you know, multinationals, right? I'm the U.S., and I'm calling a Canadian office, and I'm just trying to figure out some stuff there. You know, other areas that I like to exploit are, you know, for quick stuff like that would be, you know, travel. So, you know, I'm coming on site and I need to confirm, you know, some information before I get there. And the way I kind of lay that out is I preload it. So with a lot of questions that are very innocuous and are more based around my actual visit, right? I'm looking for hotel information, looking for tourist sites. Is there anywhere good to eat? You know, what about car rentals? All that stuff. I burn a lot of time doing stuff like that. And then once they have said in their mind that I'm coming at this later point, then I kind of come in and I start asking more probing questions. Because at that point, any sort of defense they might have had up front is kind of whittled away because they start thinking, okay, I'm going to have time to check this guy's story out. But over time, you kind of wear them down and get them into this, buying into this, you know, theme that you're going to be there at some date down the road. And they kind of do this transferal of trust. You know, this you know, initial thing, well, I'll check it out because I have this time, gets kind of overridden by the assumption that, okay, this guy's legit. He's coming out at some other point. And then they start giving you information. If I'm doing, though, an attack for a client that's not necessarily penetration test-based, but more for like ongoing information gathering, say for corporate intelligence, that sort of thing, I like to do what I call persistent social threats, PSTs, which is basically the social engineering version of the ABT, right? I like to build a long-standing relationship with someone so that I can pick up the phone and call them up months later, weeks later, you know, even a year later, and get information from them based on this prior relationship that we've built up. So to do that, the area, you know, the attack surface that I exploit usually is common ground. So, you know, I will profile the living daylights out of my targets so that I know everything about them, where they went to school, their interests, their hobbies, if they have kids, if they have religious beliefs or what have you. And I will target the attack specifically for those people, you know, be it an accidental meeting of them somewhere, or, you know, happen to connect to them via an online forum or what have you. There's lots of different ways to do that. I mean, people in social media just leave massive, massive trails that are really easy to exploit. So the attack surface is pretty much anything that I can, you know, grab on social media or, you know, any of the various profiling tools I have. I mean, it's such a vast attack surface. I mean, people are very complex and their lives are very complex. So you can really, insert yourself into many different areas of their life. You know, the question is, how do you do it most efficiently so that you can kind of pivot from that into your attack, if you know, if that makes sense.
Interesting. So before we get into sort of the question of research and sort of, you know, social media, you know, sure, how do you build a defense to this? Because it seems like you've described the attack surface as almost infinite. You know, an attacker can potentially choose, you know, thousands, if not millions of, you know, potential vectors. So,
yeah,
you know, how do you build a defense or even attempt to build a defense towards these sort of attacks?
You know, and I'm asked that all the time. And I think it was Schneier a while ago wrote, you know, there's no point in this, you know, teaching, you know, trying to defend against this stuff because it's, you can't defend against it. It might not have been Schneier, it might have been someone else. But, you know, the answer isn't that, you know, well, security training's not effective. The answer is, well, bad security training's not effective, right? We need to really change the training paradigm and the paradigm, you know, of the way we expect our workers to kind of do their jobs, right? We need to teach them it's okay to say no. It's okay that if your spidey sense is tingling, to hang up the phone or to escalate. If you think something's wrong, something's wrong. There's a reason we have these six senses, right? You have this intuition. For whatever reason, we can tell when something's hinky. You know, and it's funny. It takes us a long time in life to actually master this skill. But for the longest time in life, even though I've been doing social engineering attacks, you know, for a living since I was like early 20s, I would still, up until into my mid-30s, be interacting with people and, you know, get this really odd feeling like, something doesn't feel right. I don't trust this guy or whatever. And I would override it like 99% of people do. It was only after, you know, so many times of being burned that you realize, you know what? If something feels wrong, something's wrong. You just have to trust your gut. So that's really a key component, is teaching people trust your gut. We also have to teach them not to be trusting, right? I mean, And I saw an article the other day about how help desk is like the perfect, place, because we want, they're very, very helpful to users. They want to make the user's experience, as efficient and enjoyable as possible. I understand that, but we need to change that. You want your help desk guys to help your employees. Of course, they're not there to be a barrier. They're there to be helpful. But they're there to be helpful to employees. So if they can't vet that employee 100%, they should not be helping them. So you need to have really rigorous authentication or validation or verification methodologies in place within your help desk. As to other things people can do, I mean, they just need to be savvy. I find it really easy, really effective to have people spend some time just going over their own social media profiles and do mining. And a really effective thing that I've had people do is actually start mining friends. Information. I say, pick a friend that you – like an acquaintance, more of an acquaintance than a friend. And I want you to start digging. And I want you to spend 2 hours and find every single thing you can about this person. And if this person has any – iota of a social media presence, it becomes very quickly apparent to the person building the dossier on this person that holy mackerel, it's amazing how much I can build just off of what's out there. And every time I run people through this exercise, invariably when I go to check their profiles the following week, it's locked down. They shut down social media accounts, or they turn them private, or they scrub them. I mean, it's really an eye-opener. I mean, in that way, I think that's really an effective method, is to get people to be aware of what they've posted in social media, so that if it's thrown back at them, they can say, oh, right, I know that I've posted that, right? So do a deep dive on yourself, what you've posted out there. Do a deep dive on your friends so you know what they've posted out there, and you can see how you can build these dossiers. Those two things together, I find, are really effective training for people. The problem is, you'll find most companies don't want to spend the time, to have your people spend a day doing security orientation. They want it done in a half hour, an hour max, and then that's kind of, then they're done and they're moving on to, it's more important for them to figure out, here's how you get your health benefits or, all the other stuff. Meanwhile, these people, these companies have these workers working with, PII, personally identifiable information and very sensitive information. I don't think you're going to have a real change to the threat to social engineering until we see, an awareness within upper management that, good security training takes more than an hour. There are companies out there that recognize that, but they're few and far between.
So let me ask you, how do you do research for this sort of attack? Uh-huh. Because it seems like, my first inclination, or at least the first, vision in my head is somebody furiously, using Multigo or, Google. But I mean, does your research for a potential target on a potential target extend to, social media APIs, are we even talking to the point where you're looking at legal records and really, anything that's out and open that's you would consider open source?
Oh, good Lord. Yeah. I mean, I'm teaching a 2-day course at Black Hat that's coming up, and as I'm going through the course, my outline, I'm having to cut stuff. And this is, spending maybe 10 minutes per site, and I've already had to cut, over 100 sites just from talking. It really depends on the client and what the outcome is, but I will spend any minimum of hours to weeks, really depending on who the target is, what the goal is. I mean, if I'm going to be building an APT, or, I have only one crack at one call that I get to make, or, I'm going doing a physical on-site where I, have one whack at the pinata, I'll do weeks and weeks of research, because I want to make sure that when I go in, I knock it out of the park. But let me just go through the list of stuff I do. I mean, I just want to pick up a bunch of the different sites I do. But, I'll go, obviously you do the IP or the network profiling itself, and a lot of stuff drops out of that. But once you start grabbing social media sites, you can really start building big trees, right? So I'll go to I'll start grabbing a few of my target people. So obviously I'll profile the company. I'll go to, say, LinkedIn, and this is a very off the cuff kind of assessment, but you know, I'll run that company name through LinkedIn. I'll go through Facebook. I'll go through Twitter. Grab some names. I'll go to Shodan, see what drops out of there. Good Lord. I'll go to sites like Glassdoor, Career Bliss, read all the politics about what's going on there. I'll go to Jigsaw. That's a great site. I will go to Pacer. I'll pull legal stuff. Lots of job sites. I mean, they're golden. They tell me all about the technology that's there. I'll look for, you know, if I look at LinkedIn and I look at the job sites, I've got scripts that I'll run, and they basically start showing me, well, here's where churn is, right? Here's where there's been multiple people coming and going, or layoffs, or if I see repeated job postings over periods of time within a specific department, I know that department is experiencing problems of some sort. Either it's budgeting, either it's politics, but something's going wrong there, right? A high turnover is not a good sign for a company. For a social engineer, it's a fantastic sign, because that gives you a lot of pretext to go in, right? I'm a temp, I'm a contractor, I'm a consultant to come in to find out why we're having so many problems with churn. I mean, there's lots of things you can do there. Grab peer-to-peer sites, you know, look for leaked documents, Ice Rocket. Obviously, Google is just fantastic. Bing is fantastic. And what's really funny, too, is I find a lot of people will go to Google, and they'll go out of their way to make sure that stuff gets buried on Google or whatever, and they really don't pay attention to Bing. I find a lot of stuff shows up on Bing that's not, for whatever reason, indexed prominently on Google. Let's see. Tax records. If I'm trying to find someone's home address, and I mean, that's, you know, I guess we'll get into the ethics later, but I mean, profiling people's home addresses is a very effective tool, because that tells me a lot about them too, you know. And you know, one of the favorite things I'll like to do is I'll send out a DVD, and this is not necessarily social engineering, this is more of a information gathering or a red team test, but you know, send out a DVD branded in the company's name to that home address, you know, that, hey, here's, you know, free software for your home, because we want to make sure that our employees are protected at home as well as at work. It's amazing how many people will go through that. We'll actually insert those DVDs and install their antivirus. Let's see, Spokio, fantastic term, website, I mean. Then, I mean, I'll run any usernames that they can find through stuff like Check Username or Username Check or Noem. I mean, there's a bunch of these different things. And they'll crawl all the social media sites, and they'll tell you, well, here's where that particular username is used. So that, instead of you having to do it manually, it does it for you in a matter of, you know, a couple minutes. So that's always really easy. I mean, I'll even profile targets' sleeping time. So if we will do analysis on, here's the number, you know, the hours on average that they tweet or that they post to forums, or you know, that we've seen general online activity. You know, Social Mention is a great site, especially if you look at the top users. You can build a really accurate, not all the time, but sometimes a really accurate list of kind of relationships with that tool. I don't know if I mentioned Ice Rocket, Reddit. I mean, there's just a shit ton of things you can do. I mean, Technorati. I mean, yeah, you can just find so many things out there. Yeah, I mean, it's not funny. ScribeD. And then, you know, obviously you grab stuff off the internet, run them through a lot of metadata tools. So EXIF tool, Foca. You can run tools like Metagoofil. I mean, there's just so many things you can do. And I mean, Multigo is nice. Every time I hear people talk about social engineering, they're like, oh, well, Multigo. And Multigo is nice. And Multigo is a great way to actually kind of map what you're finding. You know, it does let you do a lot of mining as well. But I use Multigo more for laying stuff out. Not more for, I would say as much as, laying stuff out in logical forms, as I do for using it to do the mining.
Let me sort of ask you then, I mean, you've described very much an intelligence sort of gathering process.
Sure.
What does the sort of counterintelligence look like then? I mean, it seems like if you know, if somebody is aware of, you know, their user habits, you know, the documents that are out on Google and Bing, you know, can an adversary or can the target engage in counterintelligence? I mean,
sure. And I recommend people do that all the time. I mean, I'll routinely tweet out stuff on my line that's total BS just to see if it ever comes back to me. Right. So someone that's trying to make that relationship. Oh, yeah, I remember. I don't know if you remember. We met at such and such a conference. I'm like, oh, really? Interesting. Because I've never been to that conference. I've tweeted I was there. I wasn't there. Yeah, I mean, I have clients that will do that will post bad data, deliberately so that if you actually see some of the stuff coming back in queries or you see these sites that are being probed, that tells them, hey, guess what? Someone's out there. I mean, there are definitely social media honeypots you can put out there, and I recommend it. Dissemination of false information or misleading information or traps is very effective. But if you're relying that solely on protecting your ass in a social engineering attack, not your best strategy. Again, the best strategy is teaching your people. Yeah, and again, I want to go back just a bit to talking about training people in social engineering. I keep hearing this all the time. I see this all the time in the, corporate training. It's like, our help desk will never ask you for your password. Sure. You know what? I've been doing social engineering engagement for 3 years now. Never asked a person for their password. That's just, it's okay advice to give to people, but it's not the right advice to give to people, right? The advice you want to give to people is, hey, if I'm engaging with this guy on the phone for a half hour and I'm really enjoying myself in this conversation, I need to step back and ask, why am I enjoying myself this much in this conversation? Am I being played? Right? That's the training you need to give people. Not, the specific questions that are going to be asked, because a good social engineer isn't going to be asking you those questions.
Interesting. So let me switch to, the topic of vulnerability assessments and red
sure.
teaming. So walk us through, give us your definition of what you consider, what is a vulnerability assessment and then what is red teaming? And, are these two concepts sort of intertwined and together?
Well, they absolutely are. And I'm seeing this big trend today to red teaming, pen testing. We got a pen test, we got a red team, we got a red team. And they do that without ever having done the vulnerability assessment. And that's just a gigantic waste of money. And when I first started out in this business, that was the whole hotness was pen testing. I mean, that was my first gig. I hired straight out of college, start pen testing. And it was fun, pen test. And you break in. And that's great. But you know what? The actual value to the enterprise is zero if they haven't done a vulnerability assessment, right? The vulnerability assessment is you go through your enterprise and you say, here are my vulnerabilities. These are my vulnerable systems. These are my attack surfaces. Here's what I need to do to reduce these exposures. How do you know to fix these vulnerabilities? Once you've done that, then you do the red team. Then you do the pen test. That gives you the assessment now of how effective have my mitigations been, right? How have I executed on patching these vulnerabilities or fixing these vulnerabilities? Because if you're doing a pen test without the vulnerability assessment, well, you're telling them that they've got holes. Great. But you're not telling them all the holes they have, and it might be hot and sexy and stuff, and it might actually help you get a compliance checkbox, but you've really missed the much bigger chunk to do, which is the vulnerability assessment. I mean, that's priceless in my opinion. If you hire someone to do a pen test and your tech team is already well aware of these vulnerabilities and they get in, you're just going to piss off your tech team. Because they're going to be saying, yeah, we know. We've told you about this. And I've seen that happen so many times. And, you know, it just infuriates your IT guys because they're like, yeah, we know. We've been telling you guys about this problem for ages, but you guys won't address it. And yet you hire some guy who comes in and exploits that hole to get in, and he's done. And people have to understand, too, a red team is just get in. It's not get in every possible way you can get in. It's get in. Well, you know, that's, you know, your mileage may certainly vary. And especially, you know, a lot of it also depends on how well your red team contract is written and how good your red team is. You know, like I've seen a lot of places where it's like, this is your target. Once you've got it, the red team's done. Like, okay. I would much rather say you have this period of time, you know, get as many possible flags as you can or as many possible, you know, exploits as you can, and, you know, you're done. But, you know, again, it really depends on the company, the budget, you know, the red team you're engaging, that sort of thing.
Let me ask you, when you come up to a vulnerability assessment and sort of red teaming and you want to evaluate this company, you know, and you're using the social engineering tools we discussed in the first part of the show, what are some of the problems? I mean, have you ever run into a false positive or a false negative or, you know,
sure.
Walk us through, like, I mean, what are some of the problems that, you know, you might run into?
Well, I mean, the biggest false positive that I run into is, you know, social media, like profiling people that, you know, have common names. I mean, you know, if your main target is a Joe Smith, yeah, you're going to have problems. Yeah, obviously, if your name is like an Ashok Kumar, that makes it a lot easier. But you know, even with all these, you know, large, you know, data sets that are out there, you can usually overcome that, you know, just by doing a lot more correlation of stuff, you know, a correlation of a lot of other data points. I mean, I've never really run into anything that was a showstopper. I would say some companies definitely make it much, much, much harder to harvest the information that you can leverage in a social engineering attack. But even, you know, even the guys that are most stringent with social media, you know, just to run a business in this day and age, you need to bleed data. I mean, that's the reality. You know, if you need to hire guys to work on your systems, and you're not using just private headhunters, you know, and you're posting on job boards, you're exposing, you know, that core component, right? I need someone that programs with the following languages or has experience with the following devices, right? I mean, it's next to impossible to avoid bleeding data. I mean, the question is, how much data do you bleed? I mean, the other question, you know, I guess people have to understand, or not question, the other thing people have to understand is, you know, if you have a determined attacker, be it a social engineer or a pen tester or you're just a hacker, they're going to get in. You really need to focus efforts in this day and age on mitigation, right? How do I minimize the risk of a breach? How do I detect a breach? You know, how do I know when data is leaving my, you know, my perimeter? And I mean, and that's really why I kind of prefer the social engineering attacks. You know, if I break in and I send you a malicious link and you click on it, that leaves a trail, right? Some sort of thing somewhere is going to log. Well, hopefully, if you know, it's a half-ass good network. But if I get someone within the company to give me that information, you know, it's never really left the company. That person gave it to me. I mean, they might have, they might be able to track it down to a user within that company, but that's as far as it goes. And they normally won't even do that because, you know, most people, and this is kind of another big problem with security, just security in general, focus on the attackers and not the internal people, right? I mean, everyone spends their time watching the SIM for what's happening, you know, from people coming on the outside coming in. Very few places really focus on internal activity. What are people inside the company doing? So I don't know if I successfully evaded answering that question or not.
No, it's all right. I'm sort of curious then. I mean, has there ever been like an attempt by either an individual or a company to just produce a lot of false data, because it seems like that, you know, I think the advantage, maybe the only advantage of the defender is that the attacker has to sort through millions of points of data potentially.
Right.
You have to go through, you know, everything. So, I mean, you know, from the perspective of the defender, I mean, is the defender's advantage the ability to sort of produce a lot of false data? And so, I mean, not just a honeypot, but rather intentionally going out and producing, you know, 100, you know, thousands of fake Facebook profiles.
Sure.
You know, go ahead.
Yeah, well, they are. I mean, I haven't seen companies go to the extent of polluting social networks with it to that degree. I definitely know of, you know, some that do have quite a number of fake profiles out there that are completely synthetic. So when they see friend requests and when they see harvesting, you know, attempts, they monitor that. That works. The stuff where I see it more prevailing is in a lot of competitive kind of manufacturing stuff. Like, for instance, a lot of my clients in the past were plastics manufacturers. And before I get into that, I had no idea that, I mean, plastics is an extremely competitive industry, and you know, it's all based on the formula and the, you know, it's their secret sauce. It's like so they guard those secrets, you know, like their, you know, atomic secrets. And what I have seen is a lot of these places will pollute a lot of their document repositories and stuff with fake data. Only so, you know, the key, you know, their key is that only the insiders know what's legit. And if somebody were to exfiltrate all that data, they wouldn't really know what's good, what's not good. Unless, of course, they also exfiltrate, well, here's the keys, to, you know, here's the key to this system so that I know what's valid, what's not valid. The risk of this, too, though, is that someone within the company not hepped into the system grabs a technical document, assumes it's correct, and goes off to the races, in which case that can cause, you know, chaos. So, you know, it's how widely do we distribute the secret, you know, that, hey, these docs are legit, these docs are bogus. So it becomes kind of a management, you know, a tracking issue. Haven't heard anything devastating happen, you know, to a company doing that. I've definitely heard of them being able to track, you know, when they start seeing documents and specific strings in the wild, that tells them, hey, someone's popped this box. Hey, someone's grabbed these docs, so we do have to do some due diligence. Most companies, though, just really don't spend the time doing it. I mean, what I find time and time again is that companies will hire people to do social media monitoring, which is great. But the problem is what they're more concerned with is brand reputation. So, you know, I'll see them going through, you know, Glassdoor and looking at some of the comments. And, you know, I've been in these meetings where these people just start angsting over these guys have posted these negative comments. And it's, you know, we really have to clamp down the negative comments, completely overlooking the fact that three comments up was someone talking about the company's super secret data center in Abilene. Right? So it's like, you're completely missing the point. You know, someone's bitching about your company. You know what's going to happen? The very fact that your top secret data center in Abilene has been outed, that's what you want to focus on. But so, I mean, what I would recommend to companies is if you're doing social media monitoring, make sure you have someone from the security team involved in that effort, because otherwise you're going to have people that are just focused on reputation management and customer service. And to that end, I mean, a lot of companies are going overboard with customer assistance and social media, and you'll see people posting case numbers and interactions going back and forth with people. You know, both sides are giving information that they should not be giving in a public forum. You know, making it very easy for someone to come in and do an account takeover. You know, or at least at the very minimum, a social engineering attack to posing as a customer.
So let me ask you, you know, for our interview and for my own, you know, education, I've read a lot about, you know, books and, you know, papers on social engineering. And within these books and papers, they always describe, you know, social engineering attacks that go really well, that, you know, make me as a sort of a layman go, wow, that's really MacGyver burn notice level stuff. But, you know, it sort of piqued my curiosity. What happens if, when a social engineering attack goes bad. So, you know, by bad, I'll describe it in, you know, the first case would be it just is not successful. Nothing else happens. So the target does not, you know, is not, you know, the attack is just plain not successful, but the operation is, can still go on. But on the other hand, what happens if, you know, everything is FUBAR? You know, not only are you as the attacker outed, but everything sort of goes to hell in a handbasket. You know, what do you do as an attacker to sort of adapt towards these failures or potential failures?
Well, honestly, I've been doing it a long time, and I've never had one go down the tubes. Now, that may be because I always go in prepared, you know, very, very, very much prepared. And I also always have an exit plan. That said, though, you know, I've gone into locations where they weren't going to give me access, and I was still able to turn it into getting access. So it potentially would have failed, but I was able to pull it out. So I think the way to make sure, you know, you're prepared for this is to kind of frame it so that if it fails, it puts pressure on the person that's denying you, right? So a favorite technique of mine is I'll show up to a location at like, you know, 4:55 in the afternoon, right? By cab. I show up flustered. I'm sorry. I got there. I just flew in from Chicago. My flight's been delayed. It's just been a hellish day. I was supposed to be there at 1:00. I'm so sorry for being delayed. Is he still here? I obviously know the guy I'm supposed to see isn't there. You know, well, can I please get in? And if they won't let me in, you know, I kind of put up a little bit of annoyance, and then it's like, you know what? Fine, whatever. Can you just get me a taxi to the airport? I'll have to fly out again, you know, next month or maybe the month after, because I'm kind of booked up until then. And at that point, I've yet to have even the most obnoxious anal retentive security guard or receptionist not relent. Because at that point, you know, I'm not making a big scene about it. I'm just kind of resigned to the fact, send me back. And then at that point, they realize they're like, shit, I might be costing the company money. I might be causing this company to be delayed, you know, and they're basically putting what I call the stressor. They're putting the stressor on themselves. You know, I see a lot of guys that go into these places and then they're surprised when the social engineering attack fails, but they go in kind of all burn notice-y, right? And they use what I call stressors, which is where you kind of put the person on the defensive. So it's like, I'm here to do a spot security audit and, you know, I can't believe you're not in uniform, or you know, these are clear violations, let me in, or what have you, a very aggressive tone, or, you know, say, I'm an auditor, I'm here, right? Anything that you, any interaction that puts someone on the defensive is what I call a stressor. And if you're putting a stressor on someone, it does work sometimes, but it also doesn't work a lot of times because it puts people on the defensive. I like to use what are called lullers, right? It lulls them into a sense of security. Help either elicit sympathy or kinship with me, but it doesn't put them on the defensive. If, however, I, you know, by my very luller action, make them instill themselves a stressor response, right? Like me saying, it's okay, just call me a taxi, I'll go back to the airport. That really works well because they identify with the stressor, but they're putting it on themselves. You're not doing it to them. So I find it's very, very effective. But other than that, you know, other than getting initial rebuffs in person, I've never actually had an attack not go well. On the phone, I've had lots of people turn me down. You know, my first call will be nothing, the second call nothing, and then the third guy, it works. But to make that happen, you know, I will pick geographically disparate locations, different departments, so that if one goes, I throw that away. I've got my next pretext ready to go with this next target. So that, you know, even if, you know, the person, it fails, they hang up, they go, yeah, that guy just tried to social engineer me, tells everyone in that department, well, guess what? I'm not going to target that department, and I'm not even targeting that building, you know, in my next call that's 30 seconds later. So, you know, if it doesn't work with one person, move to the next. But one-on-one, never had one go down the drain. I'm always prepared for it, though. I mean, I think that's the most, you know, gut-wrenching part of doing an on-site social engineering attack is that the anticipation that it's just going to go to hell in a handbasket, and you're going to be surrounded with sirens and placed in cuffs. But I always tell people it's always good to have a scanner, always good to monitor the security frequencies, always good to listen to PD, and have someone waiting for you down the block in a car ready to go. But yeah, luckily I've never had to implement that.
So for my last sort of set of questions, I'm curious about sort of the ethics and the legality of this, because it seems like, you know, throughout our conversation, you know, we've discussed, you know, vulnerability assessment, social engineering, red teaming, but, you know, what are some of the ethical issues that come up and some of the legal issues? Because it seems like you always end up with a lot of information either in your head, on your hard drive. You know, what do you do with it?
Right. That's a great question. Not going to answer what I do then.
Right.
No. Look, there are a bunch of different ethical questions with this. You know, when I started out, you know, I did pen testing for, you know, I guess it was 12 years. And then I did one engagement where it was, you know, I did five banks. And I got into five bank branches in one day. And at the end of the day, you know, I ended up at this one branch where there was this one guy who happened to be the only black dude of, you know, in the entire bank over 5 days or five branches. He was the only black dude that I encountered. Nicest bank manager I ever met in my life. While I was listening to him, you know, while I was waiting, he was counseling a woman that had come in for a loan. She obviously didn't have credit, wasn't going to get a loan. This guy spent a good half hour on the phone hooking her up with social services, a community outreach program stuff to make sure she was looked after. And I was like, man, this guy is the salt of the earth. I ended up, of course, owning him, as I did every other branch. And when the gig was wrapped up, I found out that they'd fired the black dude. The one nice guy I encountered the whole time. They whacked him. Even though I even got way deeper into some of the other branches, he was the guy that got let go. And that kind of killed pen testing for me. I mean, I didn't do a pen test for many, 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 many years after that. It's only actually recently that I've started doing them again. So when I do a pen test, I make sure that that clause is in there now, that under no circumstances can anyone be fired for failing a social engineering attempt. Because quite frankly, if you're a really good social engineering and you do the due diligence and the research of your targets, you're going to get in. I don't care who the target is. So I don't want anyone fired. So that for me, from an ethics point of view, is very important. And I recommend that everybody that's doing a pen test put that in there. You know, look, if somebody does something manifestly, grossly negligent, sure. But, I mean, you can't just fire one dude and all five of them, because they all let me in. They all sat me down. They all took me in and sat me down in the back room where the ATM was. You know, they all took me to where the routers were. They all took me to where all the switches were. They let me log into machines. I mean, so to pick one guy out of all of them and fire them, kind of unacceptable. It's also good to frame, you know, and again, it depends on the type of attack you're doing, but if it's for a pen test, you probably want to avoid some of the gray area type attacks, like reaching out to people through dating sites or fetishist sites. I mean, strangely enough, when you'd be amazed at the number of people that you can enumerate via some of these swinger sites and fetish sites and drug sites and, you know, kind of gray area sites, and make connections to people through that, and dating sites, obviously. That most companies want you to avoid that for obvious reasons. You know, that could be a human resources shitstorm that they don't want to deal with. I have used those, though, for more aggressive information gathering operations. They're not for your standard pen test, though. Those are more for what I call the PST attacks, the persistent social threats, that are designed more for literally penetrating a company in an ongoing basis in a really meaningful way, not just a red team where you're in to grab some flags, get the hell out and say, hey, look, we fooled you, here's how. But in actual operations where we're trying to get ongoing corporate intelligence, Yeah. So, I mean, the ethics bar and the morality bar really seems to slide on who you're doing it for and what their ground rules are. They'll set them. As for what the ground rules are within HR, you know, they seem to, you know, the wind blows a different way and there's a new set of laws. Who knows? It's always good to avoid, how do I best say this? If you're working in the corporate environment, it's best to present the most sanitized version of social media exposure that you can, I guess, is how I would say it best. You know, I don't think it's, you know, news to anybody that social media, you know, having Facebook accounts public exposes data to people. I mean, any HR person in any company out there knows that already. If you're starting to go into some of the more nefarious sites, I don't know if I would put them in my report, you know. I don't know if that's what you're looking for an answer or not.
No, I mean, that's really important. But, I mean, I'm also curious about, you know, about the legality of it. I mean, in the sense that, you know, is the lawyer your best friend in writing these contracts? Because it seems like, like, I mean, through examining, like, U.S. law, like the CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, it really seems that the law governing these sort of assessments is loose, and that if
you,
So, I mean, is the lawyer your best friend in this case?
Well, you know what? I find it best to leave the lawyers out, because when the lawyers get involved, shit gets broken. You know, they'll be the guys to tell you, here's why you can't do this and that and that. You know, they're already going to have a standard boilerplate. Look, if the best way to approach it is, if in doubt, don't do it. Really, if it feels bad, don't do it. You know, if you can use that avenue of attack to get information, you can pivot to another area. Use that other area that you pivoted to, but don't use the nefarious or the gray area site. You know, just don't refer to it. You know, obviously, I'd say most pen testers or social engineers, you know, their morality or ethics will slide on a scale that is directly proportional to the size of the engagement bill, right? So if someone's paying you a quarter mil to get a a PST going within a, you know, a major defense contractor at, you know, in a foreign country, they probably have a pretty good line of lawyers behind them that will back you up, you know, or you can certainly put it into writing that, you know, they'll provide you with some sort of assistance, you know, if you get into trouble. That it really depends, though, the level of engagement you have with this with that company. Some of them want to know every step of the way, and they'll vet it. Those are safe guys, but you're not going to get the success that you will with guys that just say, look, we want this information on this company. Here's your money. Go. We don't want to know how you got it. We just want the report. We just want the data. In a way, those are kind of best, because you're just giving them the final report. Here's the information. They don't need to know how you got it. They just want the info. Those are kind of the best. But if, you know, if they want like a cookbook, here's how you went and found it, you know, then you definitely need to follow, you know, their legal guidance as well as your legal guidance. I mean, anybody in this field definitely should have a corporate lawyer that's standing by. Our guys have pretty much given us free rein, as long as, you know, let me put it this way. Some of the sites to gather stuff, it's pretty hard for you not to violate the terms of service. But, you know, that website needs to know that you violated the term of service. So on your hands, you're not going to have criminal charges. You might end up with, you know, a civil suit on your hand. Has never happened to me. I mean, for instance, if you're writing something to, you know, a bot to harvest stuff from Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter, yeah, you're probably going to get a cease and desist if you haven't written that bot properly. But, you know, it's not like you're going to be the first person to get a cease and desist from Twitter for harvesting their stuff or Facebook, you know. So, you know, it's like most legal things. It's open to interpretation, and, you know, 10 different lawyers will tell you 10 different things. You know, write the contract so that you have, you know, you disclose the least amount is probably the best way to say it. You know, try and, you know, play by the straight and narrow, You know, I can give you an example. Prostitutes use what are called, you know, John lists, right? Or safety lists. And you can subscribe to these quite legally, and then harvest that information and find out any corresponding phone numbers to, you know, that might match up to your target organizations, right? Or, you know, your target people. That in and of itself is kind of a gray area because, well, prostitution's illegal. And it's a forum for prostitutes to share bad John experiences, right? But in these forums, you get people's email addresses, phone numbers, license plate, that sort of thing, which can be very, very useful. So if you talk to a lawyer, well, is that legal? They're going to say, well, you're, you know, buying membership in a site that's promoting prostitution or that's, you know, associating with, so you might get into legal trouble. Have I ever heard of anybody going to jail for it? No. You know, the operators of the site, they might get some problems. If the Vice Squad knocks on my door and wants to bust me for being a hooker, good luck with that. You know, anybody that pays for sex with this, going to be very sadly disappointed. you know what I mean? But there's dozens of types of sites like that out there. So you can have, you know, all these esoteric legal discussions if you want, but, you know. Keep it simple in the contract. Don't tell them what you don't have to, and you know, play, you know, by I guess play as comfortable in the OSINT sandbox as you feel comfortable playing.
So let me my last question, and I ask this to, of every guest that we have who does InfoSec type stuff.
Sure.
What do you think about hackback? You know, do you think?
Oh, it's such a terrible mistake. I mean,
okay, go.
I mean, well, let me qualify that. It's, I don't think 99% of companies out there, and I'm pulling that number out of my ass, obviously, but I don't think the vast majority of companies out there have the resources to properly do it, to properly do the attribution, and the resources to handle the blowback, if there is blowback. So, you know, I hear guys talk about, well, you know, let's automate this. You know, I see a scan from you, I'm going to scan you back. All right. What if I've popped a box at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center? And I'm using that to scan you and pop you. And you go, oh, okay, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to launch a denial of service attack against that machine. Well, bravo, sir. You just brought down a box at Sloan Kettering. Now, mind you, that box might be owned, sure. But you have no idea what else is connected to that box, right? And that's just, you know, an example off the top of my head. Attribution is such a very, very difficult thing to do. Unless your company has a top-notch threat intelligence group, that has thoroughly vetted the attacker, can do, you know, 100% attribution, like the guys on the forums, I did this, here's a, you know, here's a screen capture of my attacks, and you know, if you can do that, sure, go at it. I wouldn't do it straight from your account, I would do it from some box in the cloud. Yeah, go after them. But the number of companies out there that are capable of identifying and doing the attribution and then have the ability to actually launch an effective attack back at them is, you know, really small. I wouldn't, you know, I would tell all these people out there, you know, that are promoting and spending all this time talking about and developing programs for hackback, why don't you put your efforts into actually doing InfoSec properly in the first place so that you're not getting popped, right? Instead of companies focusing on hackback, how about focus on effective patch management? How about effective user endpoint protection? Right? I see this fail all the time in almost every company I go to. Nobody's doing the basics right, but yet they want to go to this, you know, 2.0 paradigm. Oh, we're going to hack back. And I hack back. You're not even doing the 101 defensive stuff right. You know, if and when you've got the basics done, then come back to me and start talking about you want to do hack back. Until then, spend your time fixing the gaps, patching stuff, doing proper vulnerability assessments, tracking your end users, tracking your social media profile, all that stuff. When you've got all that stuff combined and you have an effective threat intelligence program, sure, come back to me and talk about doing hackback. But until then, please just STFU.
So Before,
I mean, was that ranty enough?
That was perfect.
I'm sorry, man. It's the one topic that just kind of drives me around the edge. Like, if you're the Army, sure. If you're the military, fine. You get the resources. But if you're like some corporation, you know, believe me, you're InfoSec. You're a cost center. You're not, you know, you're not a profit center. So the last thing they want you doing is using more stuff that's going to possibly piss off attackers that in turn makes them come back after you even, you know, hot and heavier. Like, just... Don't bother.
Okay. Now that, I think that's the general reaction. We've had like 6 or 7 people who basically have given approximately that same answer with the almost
not
the
as many F-bombs though.
but let me, you know, for, you know, before we end the interview and, you know, give us a, you know, encapsulating comment. You know, did we miss anything? You know, a summary or something to leave the audience with, and you know, to remember. You know, to sort of, you know, get at the core of, you know, why social engineering and vulnerability assessments are important.
Vulnerability assessments are important because they help you identify the basics, and so few companies are doing it. You know, it's really important to get the basics done. You know, the more time I spend within these Fortune 50, Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies, the thing I see is that the basics aren't getting done. You know, I think if most shareholders of most of these companies knew what was going on, they'd be pulling their money out of the companies. I mean, it should not come as a surprise to anybody when they see major corporations are popped. To me, the shock is that less companies are on the front page. You know, I think the majority of them just haven't detected the fact that they're popped. I think corporate America needs to accept someone's going to get in. If I'm on your red team, I'm going to get in. I don't care what protection you've put in. If I can exploit a network element or an application element, I'm going to exploit a human element. But I'm going to get in. We need to take this discussion out of, you know, preventing intrusions and get into mitigation. You know, how do we reduce the risks of someone being in? What now? How do we detect data going out? How do we, you know, handle that data that's inside? Make sure it's encrypted. Make sure we're storing those keys properly, that we're aging them and rotating them properly. You know, that, you know, everybody in the company isn't, you know, running local admin. And, you know, let's just do the basics. Get the stuff locked down. Assume you're going to get breached and build your InfoSec with that in mind. You know, this ain't the 90s anymore. You know, when we had this kind of idea, well, if you just put more firewalls up and better intrusion detection and all that stuff, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. The human element's always going to fail. And your technical element is usually going to fail too. Protect your data. Figure out what's important to protect, and focus your efforts on that. You know, I think things like PCI and some of these audit standards that have come out have made, and I understand the whole reason we did them, and it was admirable, but I think they failed miserably and have muddied the water, right? So how many times do we hear people saying, well, we've passed PCI audits, so we're secure? I mean, I swear my eyes roll into the back of my head and I just start to foam at the mouth, you know? No, you're PCI compliant, right? Compliance is not equal to security. You know, we really need to kind of move out of this audit-based environment and into more of a security-based environment. And in that security-based environment, you know, focus more on mitigations rather than preventive controls. And I'm not saying don't do preventive controls. Obviously do preventive controls, but do them with it in mind that you're going to get popped, because you're going to get popped.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. It was fun.
Sure.
Thanks for letting me rant.
Oh, no problem. Okay.